All right, everybody, welcome back to the Invisible College. You've been listening to the Internationale, the International Communist Anthem, sung by, I found this video on YouTube, sung by Militant Tendency, a Trotskyist faction of the British Labour Party, at a meeting in Liverpool. That's all it says, this video from 2014. It looks... The visuals look much older than that. It looks like maybe it's from the 80s or 90s. And so that, to borrow from the language of today's author, is my striking of the keynote of our discussion today of Charles Dickens and his Condition of England novel, his industrial novel, Hard Times. The worldview represented by the Internationale will be a view disputed and more or less rejected in Hard Times, except insofar as each is premised on some version of Christian eschatology, which the lyrics of the Internationale, more than other types of Marxist or communist discourse, makes clear. With its clear millenarianism. There are many different versions of the song and different lyrics, but they often speak of the final conflict, the world will rise on new foundations, etc., etc. There are other versions that are more secular. I'm getting hung up on the possible Christian, chiliasm of the Internationale. That's not the point. The point is the overall view of a communist revolution or some version thereof is considered in Hard Times and dismissed. And so it's somewhat ironic that I'm choosing the Internationale as the introductory music, the introductory anthem for our discussion of Charles Dickens, because he is going to end up somewhere else in his vision of what to do about the problem posed by class warfare in the 19th century. And we'll see where that is that he ends up and what we think of it. I am your host, John Pistelli. This is again The Invisible College, my series of literature courses for paid subscribers to my Substack, grandhotelabyss.substack.com. That is where you should go if you are a free subscriber listening to this early. I usually let the first 10 to 20 minutes be a free sample. If you're listening to this, you'll want to go to grandhotelabyss.substack.com and offer a paid subscription so you can find out where Charles Dickens will end up with all of this discourse of industrialism and class warfare and more. There's a lot of interesting information and thoughts here in the Invisible College about some of these pressing topics. And if you are listening to this as a paid subscriber, you will, of course, want to go to grandhotelabyss.substack.com to download the slideshow corresponding to this lecture, which I will begin to go through soon. Every lecture has a slideshow, almost as if we were in a real college. And so that's where you'll want to go. Also, I'm releasing this lecture in the same week in which I'm releasing my novel, Major Arcana, as a print book and as an ebook, largely through Amazon. Eventually, when you start on Amazon and then it trickles out through means I don't even know to all the other resellers and retailers online. I don't even know if I get the money when you buy it through those other people. But it's on Amazon now. By the time you're listening to this, Major Arcana by John Pistelli will be available in a print copy and in at least a Kindle version on Amazon.com. I know some of the people, even people who are paid subscribers, said that they would prefer to read it in print, even though they were paid subscribers, to kind of support it during its serialization on Substack. So by the time you're listening to this, my Dickensian serial will be available in a print edition. So those are my only two announcements. We are continuing our march through the Victorian era. We've looked at Tennyson. We've looked at the Brownings. We made a brief visitation of John Ruskin as well. And today we are turning to the Victorian novel with the major sort of. We'll talk about that. The major Victorian novelist, Charles Dickens. And we're also going to visit another Victorian sage. We will have to discuss. Those are those prophetic nonfiction writers of the Victorian era that I suggested were playing the role in the Victorian era, something like the role the poets played in the Romantic era. So we are going to talk about Thomas Carlyle today, because he is, among other things, the dedicatee of Hard Times, and he is also a crucial and influential figure in the 19th century, both in England and in America, both on literature and on politics, and in every way, as we'll see. So that is the agenda, that is the itinerary. Today we turn back to the novel after visiting Jane Austen. So Austen and Dickens are probably the two most popular novelists to this day of the 19th century. There are popular novels like Frankenstein toward the beginning of the 19th century, or Dracula at the end, sort of popular gothic novels that are more one-offs, that are maybe even more widely read than Austen or Dickens, but they are the ones that sort of hold the field as the popular novelists. That's kind of retrospective in Austen's case. She was not as big in her time as, for instance, Sir Walter Scott was. In Dickens' case, he was the major novelist of his time, to the point where it can't be ignored. Not always the best-selling, sometimes the best-selling, but not always. And we don't read all the Victorian bestsellers anymore. So it's not just that we read him because he was a bestseller and we can't ignore him on those grounds, because there are best-selling Victorian novelists that you've never heard of, Ouida, you know, Marie Corelli, people like this, that we don't read, but we do read him. Now, his reputation goes through ups and downs relative to his rivals, and I'll talk about that when I talk about his legacy, but he is the most important of the Victorian novelists in his time and after his time, I would argue. And so we are going to look at his book, Hard Times. I'll explain why Hard Times in a moment. I'm trying to think if I have any other generalizations to make. No, we are marching through the Victorian era. We're still in the kind of mid to high Victorian era that we were in with Tennyson and the Brownings. And we are going to kind of make our last stop there next week when we look at Gerard Manley Hopkins, though he is kind of a liminal figure, as we'll see. And I want to look, I think, at Christina Rossetti, too. And then after that, we'll be on to the late Victorians, to Wilde and Shaw and Conrad, all of whom in certain ways belong almost to the 20th century. So that is where we're going. That's the itinerary, and we're on our way there. All right, so welcome back to the Invisible College. Let's get into it. That wasn't a bad preamble. I usually talk for 20 minutes before I get to my slideshow. This has only been 10. I still don't know what I've been saying for 10 minutes, but at least it wasn't 20. All right, I hope we're having fun here. So I'm going to look at my slideshow. The title of this lecture, and this is the first time I've done this, every title up till now has been a quotation from the author under review. But for this one, I have chosen a phrase said about the author under review by someone else. And I'll explain who that was and in what circumstances and why I think it's particularly appropriate to Charles Dickens. But the title of this lecture is In a Circle of Stage Fire. So Charles Dickens in a Circle of Stage Fire. I almost called it We Must Be Amused, but for obvious reasons, we will talk about that, but for obvious reasons, I didn't call it We Must Be Amused. So In a Circle of Stage Fire. I have several images on my initial slide here, and I'll explain what those are briefly. It's interesting when you use, I'm an Apple person, for better or for worse. I'm sort of locked in now. The cloud has everything. So I don't know how I would not be an Apple person, even if I wanted to at this point. But I am an Apple person, so I use the Keynote app, which is their slideshow app. And they And I think it's the same on all slideshow apps, they or programs, they offer you, when you make a new file, they offer you a series of templates to choose from. And so it's always interesting what template you'll choose for illustrative purposes. And I usually try to choose one that somehow has the right aesthetic for what I'm talking about in some ineffable way. I don't try to overthink it, but I usually make some kind of intuitive choice. And it's not a, it's a fairly limited selection. It's like 30 palette, there are 30 templates. But I had to choose. There's one called, they all have names. They all have names, like the names of, I mean, everything aesthetic has names. Like if you choose a paint color for your house, or if, you know, makeup all has these weird names. So these have the same kind of names. So they have one called industrial. So I couldn't not choose industrial. And their template for industrial is actually rather, the main type of slide, as you'll see, is rather boring and actually kind of unaesthetic. But the title slide setup, their format, is four images are available. And then they have different slots for different texts. And they even have like date project. I deleted those. I deleted because I don't put the dates on the slides. but so I did tweak it a little. But it allows, most of the templates only allow for one image on the kind of cover slide. But this one allows for four. So I've put in four. The first one, the one on the left, whenever you're looking at this, is a painting by Turner. I mentioned Turner a few weeks ago when we were discussing John Ruskin and how Ruskin was a champion of various contemporary painters in his time. And one of these was Turner, and Turner was renowned for his landscape paintings that were anticipatory of and influential on things like Impressionism and even abstract art, in the way that their depiction of the landscape foregrounds the sense that you are looking at an interaction of colors and forms and shapes. It kind of de-emphasizes the realism of the picture. It creates a sense of that sort of, you know, what's been scorned by Philistines is the myopia that you get in Impressionism. This the way that you're looking through this landscape, not, it's very anti-Blakean. It's not a series of bounded lines by any means. It's a series of masses of color. And so I mentioned that, and I thought we'd look at a Turner painting. I never put the titles on. This one's called, like, Train, Steam, Mist, Steamboats, Viaducts, Railways. I don't know what it's called, but it's a train, a steam-powered, you know, locomotive going over a bridge, kind of coming towards you over a kind of misty landscape. And this is often said to be Turner's industrial age painting, the painting where, you know, you have something in the landscape that an earlier generation of landscape painters like Constable or Gainsborough couldn't have painted, because there was no railroad crossing these landscapes in 1790 the way there is when Turner is painting this in the 1840s. So this this landscape painting with modernity, landscape with modernity, the railroad, the coming of the railroad being such a key sign of the modern, the industrial modern in this era. So that's one illustration. My other larger, there's two like large slots for an illustration and two smaller ones. My other large one is an illustration from the first book publication of Hard Times. It was serialized in a one of Dickens's magazines, but it was not illustrated in its first serialization, but it was illustrated in its first book publication. And so I have the scene of the death of Stephen Blackpool and the way in which it looks some sort of evocative of a kind of pietà. And I want to talk about the Christian imagery in the novel and the sense of Christianity in the novel, as we see Rachel, his beloved Rachel, bending over Stephen Blackpool as he dies. Or maybe it's supposed to be Louisa, where, and Rachel is crying. I can't quite tell, but the point is the kind of arrangement, the composition, the imagery has this Christ-like pietà-like vibe to it, which I think is appropriate for some of the Christian elements of the novel that I want to discuss. And then my other two sort of inset illustrations are just Dickens, a photograph of Dickens at work at his writing desk, and the sort of first page of the first serialization in his magazine, Household Words. So you can see what this would look like. It looks more to us like a newspaper. It's not like a, this was before you could have the kind of printing, like color lithography printing, that would only develop at the end of the 19th century, where a magazine would be something that had like a glossy, colorful cover. And then you'd open it up and maybe encounter newsprint or pulp paper. This was, the whole thing is kind of like pulp paper, and it just begins, there's like a, the title of the magazine is just the headline, Household Words, which is a weekly journal conducted by Charles Dickens. I like that phrase. So he was the editor, and he serializes his own book. And that was him doing everybody else involved a favor, because one of the reasons he didn't even want to write Hard Times particularly, he was exhausted, he had just finished Bleak House, and he wanted to take some time off from writing novels. But his journal, the journal he's conducting, Household Words, that title, that very title, evocative of the domestic, the household, who he's addressing there, even though I think it's biblical, the phrase in origin. Anyway, the circulation of the magazine was dropping off because he wasn't publishing in it. And so they were like, could you, you know, if this magazine's going to go out of business if you don't write some things. He's like, fine, I'll write another novel. Good Lord. So he writes Hard Times. So, and I'll tell you about his life in a moment and more about his writing career. But those are my illustrations on the slide. We have the illustration from the book itself, the kind of, I think this would have been an engraving, like a steel. Would it have been a steel etching? I should learn the history of printing in a little more detail. I know it in general, largely due to my teaching the comic book classes in the art school, but I don't have as detailed a knowledge as I want. But I think it's probably like a steel engraving. And then the photo of Dickens, and then the photo of the magazine, and then the Turner landscape painting. Another thing that happened this week, this is a bit of discourse, is some museum in England was showing landscape paintings, and they were doing, you know, the little text attached to the wall was doing a version of the ideology critique of, you know, these landscape paintings may inspire nationalist feeling. And then there was a debate about this on social media and different people taking different positions. And, you know, my position on it is, well, my position on it is the problem with that, I'm totally onto a different topic. The problem with doing that kind of thing in a museum is the following. We all understand, at least everybody listening to me, if you're interested enough in this kind of thing that you're listening to me, then you understand, and I understand that kind of an ideological critique can be a phase in the reception of a work of art. I've always liked the way J.M. Coetzee, the South African novelist, put it in his essay, What is a Classic?, where he says that this is part of the test a work of art has to undergo. Is there anything left of it after this kind of harshly interrogative ideology critique? He writes this essay during the height of like political correctness, you know, in the 90s. And he's essentially saying, it's fine. Let these people do their worst. Let them come after Bach and Turner and Shakespeare, and the work will show its strength by its overcoming of this one more critical hurdle thrown in its path. So on the one hand, there's I have no particular objection. I'm going to do it to Dickens today. I mean, he makes a big target for himself, you know, for us. I'm going to do it to Dickens because I think there's elements of what he's doing here that's ideologically sort of in bad faith. But and he's going to come out of it, and I'm going to bring him out of it. I'm going to do the whole cycle. I'm going to do the ideology critique, and then I'm going to pull him out of the fire myself. And these arsonists, these critical arsonists of the left-wing ideology critique tradition don't seem to want to do that. Or they, speaking of bad faith, they act like they want to do that, but in the back of their minds as well, this stuff will be around forever because they don't want a revolution, because they don't want to take power, because they're basically irresponsible people. That's why they're merely critics and not artists. I'm being too hostile. But anyway, okay, that's fine. Ideology critique is fine. It's okay. It's a phase in the history of art and in the reception of a work of art. And it's interesting. You know, what is the political context? What is the social context? How is that played into? It's fine. It really is. The problem is when you boil that down to something small enough to put on the placard next to the painting in the museum, then that becomes that the official statement of the institution is that the series of works, the cultural tradition of which it is the custodian, its official position becomes hostile to the works. And so the works, which were the entire occasion for the founding of the institution in the first place, become discredited by the institution so that they may accredit themselves as the official kind of power brokers in a new conception of their role, which is a kind of direct intervention and managing of the emotions and the ideologies of the populace. So the museum, which in its utopian inception, after the French Revolution, which was to make the treasures of culture available to all rather than the property of the aristocracy, now becomes this kind of ministerial agency of the kind of new totalitarianism of the expert class, where you are ordered what to think. You are ordered what to think on the wall of the museum. Now, it's fine if you could go into the museum bookstore and they stock some ideology critiques of the landscape paintings. I don't think there should be anything next to the painting on the wall but bare facts. That's all I think should be next to the painting on the museum wall. I don't think we need a lecture in that circumstance. So that's one thing. And so then, however, whatever, if the ideology critique was legitimate under an old, more liberal conception of the institution's role, it becomes illegitimate because of its site of enunciation on the wall of the museum, telling you, the citizen who is now no longer a free citizen, but a subject of this new expertocracy, that's where it becomes illegitimate. That's where I don't want to hear it. There is no defense for it. And these people on Twitter who are defending it because they think they're still fighting some battle from the 90s and not recognizing the changed circumstances, especially after, I don't want to offend anybody, but especially after the pandemic and everything that went on there. I know we all have different opinions on that, but the expert class to me is, how shall I say? I don't want lectures from them. I don't want lectures from them on the wall of the museum. So in that sense, yes, the ideology critique becomes illegitimate. There we go. I knew I'd come out with something that was 12 minutes long before I got to Charles Dickens. Let's turn, my friends, to Charles Dickens. Who was Charles Dickens? That all, by the way, was about Turner. I don't even know if Turner was in the museum. I don't know if Turner inspires nationalism. I think Turner does not inspire nationalism precisely because he's